Today we will take another figure, the figure of the existentialist philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre, and I am counting him as part of the philosophical roots of psychology, and a root even though he is relatively recent. I say relatively recent because, after all, he did live in the last century. In fact, he lived in the last millennium. Now, it's true that he did not die until 1975? Let's see, I've got it here. 1980, I think he died in 1980. But his big influence on psychology was during the 1930s and the 1940s. And I think that is long enough ago, to justify including him in our list of philosophers who have made an important contribution to the discipline of psychology. And so, without further apologies, let's go. Once again, I give you the famous grid, and I do this for a number of reasons. One is to kind of give everybody a chance to settle down, to get started, and also to feel very good about yourselves because you're so smart. You know all this stuff now. And I don't want to spend the whole time reviewing everything we've said over the last 6 or 7 weeks, but I would like to just single out the first column of human development. And perhaps this is a little bit of a prejudice on my part, because this is the part of psychology that I personally am most interested in. This will not surprise you if I tell you that I have worked with Georg Lind on many of the questions that he worries about as well, namely moral psychology, or if you wish, moral judgment making. And morality, although it's not the only thing that goes into becoming a fully mature person, is an important part. And so you can see that from my own autobiography that it's the human development that I think is the most important part of each one of these weeks' worth of lectures. And not surprisingly, it is the part that we spent the most time on. We started off with Plato and talking about his idea of knowing the good, where the good was some kind of a wonderful but abstract concept, and the model there was escaping from the cave. And that's what it meant to develop as a person. For Aristotle, it meant to follow your nature. Just as the acorn follows its nature and becomes an oak tree, so also you and I should, we don't always succeed, we're not as automatic as acorns are, but we should follow our nature. And we should try to realize our goal of being fully flourishing human beings, which is to say, having capacity for thought and for love and for participation and for wisdom, but also for physical delights. Descartes had a different idea of what it consisted to be, shall we say, a grown-up. How would you say grown-up auf Deutsch? Erwachsener, yeah. Well, you see, for us in the United States, I don't know about the English, to speak of a grown-up is to take a child's perspective. And so children say, oh, what will the grown-ups want to do tonight? And so on. And so then when a group of philosophers or any professors sit around in the faculty lounge, we talk about our students and we say, well, someday they'll see what the grown-ups have had to worry about. Grown-ups meaning anybody over 50. So it's a relative term. But anyway, using this concept of grown-up in kind of a childish way to suggest that grown-ups are, they have made it. They're up there. And so for Descartes, a grown-up is someone who has achieved certainty, someone who has gone through the methodology, starting with I think, therefore I am, and finishing with all kinds of interesting ideas about the world and about God, and these ideas are all 100% certain, and that's what makes him a grown-up. We continued then with classical empiricism, and their idea of to be a grown-up meant to have a lot of experience. And experience was a combination of physical sensations, of reflecting on those physical sensations, and of course engaging in social contracts and engaging in a lot of other things that could only be done if you had had practice, if you had somebody to show you the way, somebody to shape your experiences, because none of this came naturally, that is to say, innately. And then we had this famous song and dance team, Schopenhauer and Freud. And their idea of grown-ups is basically this notion of empowerment. This is more of a Freudian idea than a Schopenhauerian idea, but as I said last week, I have no hesitation in reading Schopenhauer into Freud, or for that matter, reading Freud into Schopenhauer, because it seems to be indisputable that Freud was working, either consciously or unconsciously, out of the metaphysical model that Schopenhauer himself had proposed of die Welt aus Wille und Vorstellung. Today we talk about Jean-Paul Sartre, and for him to be a grown-up is to be authentic. It's the quest for authenticity that gives our life the richness, the excitement, and the potential for disaster that it has. And his famous examples, or his phrases, Sprichwörter, I guess you would say, are existence comes before essence, and also that we must make radical choices. And I'll explain those two key terms in a minute. I will also explain his idea of consciousness as nothingness. And I will explain very, very briefly his reference to the phenomenological method, which was his own methodological scheme. And then finally, in just the few minutes that will remain, we'll speak very, very briefly about his concept of self and society. It's not a very cheerful concept. He said, in short, that hell is other people. And I'm sure we've all felt that way from time to time, especially during class. All right. The agenda is, as before, sack, 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 historical context, big question, the four columns, then a little bit of an appendix, and so here we go. The historical context, chaos, war, anxiety, and existentialismus. A little something here for everybody. Let me get my notes here. Now, the painful political and military events of the first half of the 20th century are well known, and I'm sure they're very well known to you, even more so than people who did not grow up in Europe and did not hear stories from their own grandparents about all the things that happened in the first half of the 20th century. But anyway, even though I'm sure that you have a lot of information already, you've just inhaled it over the years. I wonder if perhaps the many forms of social and emotional crises that took place during the first half of the century are perhaps less familiar to you than the simple historical facts. And so let me just make a short summary, starting with the historical facts. The Treaty of Versailles. The dates on that? 1919. Treaty of Versailles. That was the end of the First World War. It ended the First World War. That's the good news. What's the bad news about the Treaty of Versailles? Come on, you guys are Deutschers. You're supposed to know this stuff. Right. And it created terrific economic and social hardship within Germany especially, but there were similar problems throughout Europe, especially because in the 1930s we had the World Depression. And so, without wanting to blame everything on the Treaty of Versailles, it's certainly safe to say that the two decades after the First World War were times of great instability and increasing desperation on everybody's part, but especially les Français. People no longer trusted their institutions, including their cherished traditions, and for many people, including their established religions. And so when, at the beginning of the Second World War, France fell almost immediately, and a right-wing puppet government was installed at Vichy. The French people were shocked and demoralized. Now, whatever else you want to say about the French, they are a proud people. And this came as a terrific shock to know not only that they had been defeated, but they had been defeated so easily. And the fact that they were defeated so easily by you-know-who probably didn't help anything either. But hope was not lost. The French held on, waiting for a counter-invasion. They knew that Charles de Gaulle had organized the Free French Forces in England, and the armies were about to enter the war, and a very effective French underground was successfully resisting much of the occupation. And these hopes were fulfilled in 1944. 176,000 Allied troops invaded Normandy, and the rest, as they say, was history. Now, Sartre was involved in this. He was drafted into the French army shortly before the Germans invaded, and he was captured immediately. And while he was in prison, in the prison camp, he started writing one of his most famous, probably his most famous book, Being in Nothingness. Now, I don't know the full story here, but my imagination is that one day the German commandant came through the barracks and he saw what Sartre was doing, and he said, "Let me see that." And he read it, and he said, "Send this man home. He is harmless." Anybody who would write this kind of baloney, away with him. So anyway, after a few months, maybe it was less than a few months, it was sometime between 6 weeks and 3 or 4 months, Sartre was released from prison. So he goes back to Paris. And now he's a hero. He's got his credentials. He has been a prisoner. So then he proceeded to work with the Résistance. But he worked with the Résistance as their house intellectual. He was their intellectual reader, and the Résistance was a somewhat romantic French partisan movement that continued, even in the darkest days of the war, to inspire feelings of patriotism, of heroic individualism, and stoic resolution in the face of absurdity and disillusionment. So, looking back on those times, it's very easy to tell the story as I just did. Consider the script that I was just reading from. Inspire feelings of patriotism, heroic individualism, and stoic resolution in the face of absurdity and disillusionment. And you think, yes, those were the days. Those were the days when giants walked the earth. I wish I had been there. Well, I think if you talk to anybody who was there, they would not speak in such, shall we say, romantic and affectionate terms. But Sartre came on the scene at just the right time. What I'm trying to communicate to you is that there was an historical context. Sartre was made for that context, and it's a bit much to say that this context was made for him, but it was a perfect marriage of being individual, of individual personalities and social conditions. But let me go back to Sartre's own biography for just a minute. During the 30s and even the late 20s, as a young professor, he had heard about a couple of, dare I speak the word, German philosophers, Edmund Husserl and Martin Heidegger. And he was very excited about what he heard about Edmund Husserl and the founder of the phenomenological movement. So Sartre goes sometime in the late 20s or early 30s, he goes to Berlin because he wants to learn more about it. And then, during the rest of the decade of the 1930s, he considers himself a phenomenologist. And indeed, he always considered himself something of a phenomenologist. Never mind what that word means, just trust me. And but he didn't specialize in it as intensely later in his life. But he also became very much impressed with the work of Martin Heidegger, who was himself a student of Husserl. And let's see, these guys, Husserl and Heidegger, they were both in Freiburg and Breisgau. But for some reason, Sartre felt he had to go to Berlin to learn about this stuff. I can't tell you why. But what he liked about Heidegger was Heidegger's discussion of angst and human freedom in Heidegger's famous book, Sein und Zeit. But then, as the war reached its height, in the latter days of the war, rather, in 1943, Sartre developed his own brand of this German philosophy, and he gave it the name existentialism. And so I don't want to trace all of the nationalistic characteristics of what was happening, you know, in Freiburg and Paris and Berlin and so on. But the fact is there was a kind of a confluence. The rivers were coming together and producing something very important, which dominated European thought for the next generation. After the war, Sartre continued to be a flamboyant spokesman for the left, at least in France. But during the 1950s, he abandoned the very heavy individualism of existentialism in favor of a unique but somewhat less dogmatic form of Marxism that was quite a bit ahead of its time. It was so ahead of its time that the Communist Party in France condemned Sartre for his bad reading of Marx. A decade later, when Karl Marx's Paris manuscripts, the manuscripts of 1844, which revealed, shall we say, the human face of Karl Marx, some of Sartre's interpretations of Marx were justified. But that's another story, and we won't be able to discuss that today. Instead, this is the summary of what I've just been saying. There's JP right there. I think that's Camus he's talking with. And now his big question: how can we be conscious of consciousness? Now that's not his only question, but it's the question that organizes the rest of what I am going to say today. And I think it's as good a question as any if you're going down the street and somebody jumps out with a gun and says, "Hold it, Hände hoch." What was Sartre's big question? I think this would probably be a pretty good answer. It's not the only answer, but it's a good one. This happens a lot in Chicago in certain neighborhoods. And then we have these related issues of human freedom and self-knowledge. But what's really at stake here is this idea of being conscious of consciousness. And we're going to get into this with a certain amount of detail. I hope it doesn't bore you. There's not much sex in this. But there's a little. I'll tell you about that later. So don't anybody leave. But now, just a little excursus, a little sidebar here. These are some of the more famous themes, and if you're not familiar what these words are all about, stay tuned, because we will be talking about them, not necessarily in this order. I've already indicated the idea of phenomenology. I'll try to explain it in a bit more detail in a minute. Being and Nothing, and this is not only the title of his famous book, but it's also one of the main oppositional concepts that runs through his and all of the other existentialists that came after him. And closely related to being and nothingness is the opposition between existence and essence. Although I think I should have had it backwards, because existence corresponds to being and nothingness corresponds to existence. And you'll see why in a moment. And then we have this idea of authenticity or good faith and inauthenticity, bad faith or mauvaise foi. Consciousness and selfhood are themes that we're going to come up again, and freedom and anguish or angst, and the self and other relationships. And so these are some of the hot buttons that we're going to push over the next hour or so. Now let's go to the first one: Sartre's conception of human development. He's got two, unfortunately, incompatible conceptions of the direction the human development should take, ideally. We he's got this conception of what we should try to become. In other words, we should try to become more and more authentic. That's the way it ought to be. Now, I don't know if you remember from your philosophy class that Immanuel Kant said, ought implies can. Sollen impliziert können. But, unfortunately, although Sartre had certainly read his Immanuel Kant, he didn't believe it. Because he said that what we actually do try to do is become something very much the opposite of an authentic person. What happens is that as we go on in our life, we become increasingly inauthentic. We become what is referred to in Hegelian jargon as an in itself for itself. Again, concepts that we're going to have to unpack one by one. So let's do that. Now this scheme that I've got on the screen up here, this is the Tom Wren analysis of Jean-Paul Sartre. You won't find it anywhere. You won't even find it in the Cliff Notes or Google. It's my own invention. Because Sartre himself never had an overarching category called reality that he then broke into two subordinate categories. Sartre never saw a grand unity that was then, you know, chopped down, chopped down, chopped down. For him, the opposition between being and nothingness was so basic, so stark, that he never even thought of trying to bring them together under one heading. But the reason I do this whenever I talk about Sartre is that it's important that you understand that when he speaks about nothingness, he's not speaking about simple absence, a simple vacancy. And so I've got another little trick, and this is also pure Tom Wren. And because it's pure Tom Wren, you are entitled to think that there's probably something wrong with it. I worry about that all the time. But, damn it really seems to explain things. This works in English, not in Deutsch, but in English. If you take the word nothingness and you break it into the two terms no and thingness, then it turns out that the opposition is between things or beings that have thingness and other stuff. And so reality consists in things, but it also consists in other stuff that is not properly thought of as a thing. It's properly thought of under some other category, such as freedom or consciousness and so on. And so if you will allow me the vanity of setting up this opposition as no thingness versus thingness, then I think we can make a lot of sense out of what Sartre was trying to say. But as I say that to you, I suddenly quake with fear, because it occurs to me, many of you have probably read Sartre, and you have your own views. How many of you have read anything by Jean-Paul Sartre, not counting his novels? One? I only see one? What? It used to be Sartre was on the index of forbidden books in the Catholic Church. Maybe he still is. Is that the reason you haven't read Sartre? No? Okay. It's not because he's French. No. Although, I know. I told you when we were in Salzburg last summer, didn't I? And we went to the Mozarteum to hear the it was on the Mozart Fest. My wife and I had tickets, and we were going to the Mozarteum, which is a very nice little concert hall. And we realized, oh God, we left the tickets back at the Pension. So we run back, we get the tickets, we run in, and they said, hurry, hurry. And then we came in, it was a very crowded room with all the little chairs, and the conductor was just coming out on the stage. And we had to step over all these people, and they looked at us with anger and evil looks. Talk about le regard, we're going to come back. Well, so what would you do if you were an American in this situation? I said, pardonnez-moi, merci, pardonnez-moi. Hoping that they would think if I was in French that maybe I was a Nederlander. But anyway, I was just trying to do my little bit for my country, you know, not to get us into any more trouble. We were already in the doghouse. But anyway, I guess I'm kind of happy that not too many of you have read Sartre, because then it gives me the pleasure of introducing him to you. And you won't realize how idiosyncratic some of this stuff is. But anyway, the idiosyncratic stuff, the Tom Wren stuff, is really just right up here. Everything else, all of these oppositions, I am now going to bounce off each other. This is straight out of Sartre's Being in Nothingness or related works. And I'm going to talk about them in more detail. I don't think, because of time considerations, that it's a wise thing for me to go into every one of these oppositions. I like to think the slides speak for themselves, especially because it will, as before, go on the web and you can meditate on them. I personally, as I was struggling to understand Sartre, found this dualism between consciousness and objects of consciousness, etc., very, very helpful. And so we have an object of consciousness. Okay, well, if it's an object of consciousness, then it's not consciousness. So we have consciousness, that's one thing. Well, that's one reality. And we have objects of consciousness, and that's another reality. And we have, then, being, which is understood to be anything out there that you can know. And then we have the stuff that's on the hither side, the inside of this experience, and that's not a thing. It's that which knows things, but it's not itself a thing. What is it? Well, it's consciousness, or it's subjectivity. It's indeterminate. It has no structure. It's identified with freedom. It's referred to in Deutsch using Hegel's categories as the für sich. The French is the pour soi. The English-American people usually refer to it as the for itself. And I'll come back to why they use that weird language. But the point is, this stuff is not thing. These are not things. These are all things. Things have structures. Things have determinate, sharp edges. Things are necessary. Things just exist in themselves. Things belong to the objective world, not the subjective world. Instead of subjectivity, which is the experience of that I know, it's objectivity, namely that stuff that's out there, which I know. So, let's see. Do I have this thing right? Yeah. So let's talk here. Let's talk about this idea of freedom. Now, I'm just going to go back here. So I'm talking right now about this idea of freedom versus necessity. Now, what's going to happen over the next half hour is a lot of crisscrossing, going back and forth. I have tried to put these slides in a nice order where everything just kind of leads nicely to the next thing, like a geometry theorem. And I couldn't. But I figured, well, what the heck? Each slide is suggestive of something, and maybe the cumulative effect, especially if you go back and look at these slides later, maybe you will get a total picture after all. But anyway, here we are now. We've got these examples of how freedom is essentially unstructured. It's essentially a non-thing. His first example is The Lady in the Window, which is a case study he borrowed from the French psychiatrist Janet. What happened was that this young woman, bourgeois woman, married a guy who, in the classical formulation, he didn't want his wife to work, and so she had to stay home all day, and she was bored. Ennui, plus des ennuis. Is Langweiligkeit with a capital L. Of course, it always has the capital L. But anyway, we say in English sometimes, she was bored out of her gourd. So then she started thinking, well, what if I sat out on the balcony and took my clothes off? That would be interesting. Don't be silly, I would never do that. But what if I did? Have you ever had that thought? Say you're on a bus and think, what if I just take my clothes off? Or you don't have to take your clothes off. What did you say? What if I just started singing Silent Night at the top of my voice in Bantu or something? Don't you ever think, you know, what if I did such and such? And then you say, well, don't be silly. And then you think, yeah, but what if I did? And so that's what's going on here. And so then the cartoon by my friend Donald Palmer, is she's sitting up there and she's saying, hey, isn't anyone going to look? but this is not part of the original example. Another example that Sartre, by the way, is a master of examples. It's no coincidence that he wrote many novels and plays. He has a very good sense of the concrete. The gambler in the casino. In the case of the gambler in the casino, we have, this is all hypothetical now, let's say I'll be the gambler in the casino. And I have this bad habit of making bets that I shouldn't. And I've you know, got a serious money problem as a result. Unfortunately, I work in this casino. I work in the back some places. I don't know, like cook or something. But I say, you know, this has gone far enough. I'm not going to gamble today. I'm simply not. I say this while I'm home. Okay. So I've made a resolution. Now, if there were some kind of a pill or an injection I could take, such that, well, it's like sort of a Viagra in reverse for gamblers, and so where you would walk in and you just simply wouldn't be able to make a bet. But resolutions, good resolutions are not like that. Good resolutions are not chemical. Good resolutions are matters of consciousness. They're not things. They're no things. And so anyway, he has made this very strong, very sincere, very, very, very powerful resolution. And maybe it's connected with his love life. Maybe his wife or his girlfriend has said, you either gamble and lose me, or you stop gambling and you have me. Make your choice, buddy. He says, I'm going to have you. Okay, so he walks into the casino. But there is no guarantee that he will be able to get back to the kitchen without gambling, because resolutions do not have physical force. And what if he were about halfway through the casino and he said, "Well, I made a resolution this morning, and I was very sincere. I just reached down and pulled myself up by my bootstraps, and I said, 'Ich will nicht.'" And now I'm going to do the same thing. Put the boots back up, you deal. Well, why? He's not a determinate mechanism. He's not some sort of a clock that you wind up. He's a free human spirit. And the problem is, you can make all the resolutions in the world, and there's no guarantee that when the time comes, they will have some sort of inertia value such that, you know, a thing in motion stays in motion. Resolutions are not like that. You have to make the resolution all over again as you go through the casino. And you think, I will not, I will not. You keep repeating the same resolution. And what happens if you say, I will not, I will not, I will? There's no guarantee, because you are free. The third example, the soldier before battle. I don't know whether Sartre had read the famous American novel Stephen Crane's Red Badge of Courage, but the plot is pretty much the same thing. Namely, the soldier before battle, it's the first time he's gone into battle. The first time he has gone into battle. And he's afraid. He's afraid he's going to get killed. You know, those bullets hurt. And they kill people. Especially if, you know, a cannonball also takes off your head at the same time. You know, the life expectancy on this battlefield is not good. And that's fear. But then, he thinks, well, what if I run away? And now a new emotion takes over, because he now realizes that when the time comes tomorrow, he could run away or stay and fight. Now, which is he going to do? Now, he's already got fear of damage, fear of death, but that's nothing compared to what he's experiencing now, is the possibility that all of his brave, patriotic commitment might go down the toilet when the first bullet starts to fly, and he might say, goodbye. How does he know what he is going to do? He doesn't know. And the fact that the night before he realizes that he doesn't know what he will do gives him anguish, gives him a sense of the fragility of his own personal commitments. Another example, the champion of sincerity. This is very interesting. two guys are talking, they're friends. The one fellow's had some homosexual experiences. He says to his other friend, "You know, I can't figure out why I'm always involved in these homosexual relationships. And, you know, I just go along and I wind up in bed with the strangest people." And his friend said, "Oh," he said, "come on," he said, "admit it. You're gay. You are a homosexual." They didn't use the word gay in those days. Vous êtes un homosexual. Give or take an accent mark. And that his friend is the champion of sincerity. He's saying, be sincere. Stop trying to kid yourself. Now, Sartre tells this story, and then he gives a bad mark to whom? To the homosexual man? No. It's the champion of sincerity that is the inauthentic person. Because he wants his friend to say, "I am a homosexual," the way an inkwell is an inkwell. This is Sartre's phrase. But people are not homosexuals in the same way that, for me, the water bottle is a water bottle. Because the water bottle just is. But the homosexual has decided to be a homosexual. Now, Sartre didn't know anything about all this genetic proclivity, genetic inclinations toward homosexual behavior. But even if he did, I think he would still say that with all of the biological determinism that you might know about from the laboratory, the fact is you can always decide to do otherwise. It might be more or less difficult. But hey, consider all of those priests and nuns and Buddhist monks who go through life without having any sex whatsoever. We have sexual desires, but that doesn't mean we have to implement them any one way, and it's our freedom that directs our sexuality. And so similarly, for the so-called champion of sincerity to say, admit it, you are a homosexual, stop trying to play games with yourself, the champion of sincerity is reducing his friend to the status of an inkwell, of a thing. But his friend is not a thing. His friend is a person who has chosen to act on homosexual inclinations. And then finally, walking on the bridge. I'm going to come back to that example, so let me just leave it unexplained. Yes, ma'am?
It almost like fully underestimate the power of society. I mean, like, we're not free. The woman sat there in the window naked, in the police car, or passing one of the doors. She's not free because she has to,
Well, first of all, Sartre has been criticized for exactly this point, namely of emphasizing the power of individual choices and neglecting the force of social pressures, social constructions of reality, etc. He's been criticized very, very strongly by his Marxist friends as well as by others such as people from the religious right. But he always replied, and I'm not saying this is a good reply, but he would always reply that you may be in a context where society has more or less written a script for you, the way in the theater, Shakespeare has written the script for Romeo and for Juliet. You know, and when you get to the final act, Romeo and Juliet, well, in this case, Juliet, she does not say, "Well, I wonder, should I do it or not? Should I kill myself?" No, it's in the script. She has to kill herself. But Sartre wants to say that life is not quite like that. True, we have scripts. But we can always step outside of the script and say, not today. Not today. Tomorrow maybe. And so that's his point, that although he wants to admit to the existence of terrific social pressures and customs and ingrained beliefs and automatic expectations, he always wants to say that it at least is possible in principle that you can, there's that little bit of subjectivity that you can always reach down to and bring out and say, I will do it. So, I take your point, and I think he's gone too far. But this is our friend Jean-Paul Sartre. Okay, now why does freedom mean anguish? We have to talk about, these two words, angst and furcht. Angst, or anguish, or l'angoisse in French, it's a negative emotion, much like fear, but it's in the face of an indeterminate object. Whereas fear is the negative emotion that you feel in the face of a determinate object, such as you're standing on the street, and all of a sudden you see a truck coming toward you. Oh my God! Well, there's a truck out there. Of course you're afraid. Imagine that you're put out in the middle of a, what do you call these things? Kreisel. Yeah, okay, you're in the middle of a very small kreisel in a very high-speed neighborhood, and you're blindfolded, and you hear all these noises and so on. Now, you don't know whether it's a truck or a bicycle or a noisy old man or what, but you do know that on the whole, things could be much better. You know that you've got a problem. Now, this is not really anguish. This is still a kind of a generalized fear. But imagine now that you have this negative emotion, call it fear if you wish, but it's not really fear. And they say, well, what are you afraid of? What are you afraid of? You say, I don't know. I just have this sense that something bad is happening. Well, that would be a kind of anxiety. But the discussions of anxiety have varied over the during the literature, and we had Kierkegaard come in, and he was the one who started the talk about anguish, and he said he used the word dread, which in English is interchangeable with anguish, but I don't know, apparently the Danish does distinguish between dread and anguish. And it's the emotion you have before the ultimate nothingness of my ceasing to exist. And the thought that someday I'm not going to be here. Someday Tom Wren, and fill in your own name here, will be history. And not even history. Nobody will even remember you. And this is not a comforting thought. And this is the thought that for Kierkegaard gave rise to this powerful negative emotion, which, because Kierkegaard was a religious man, caused him to bounce off the negative emotion of dread and go up and make the leap of faith. Do you remember the leap of faith? Faith? You know, where without any good scientific reason, Kierkegaard's religious man says, oh, what the hell, I believe. And that's how you recover your life, you recover your meaning, you recover your sanity, you recover all these other good things. Well, Sartre, who was by no means religious, took another approach. He said, it's the dread that you experience before the ultimate nothingness of my continuing to exist. And for Sartre, this idea that you're going to be here and continue to exist, but to continue to exist as a free agent that has to make decisions every 5 minutes, that's what he thought. That's what Sartre thought gave us the radical feeling of anxiety that he called angst. Another way of getting at this idea of angst is to talk about this thing as missing an appointment. And so Sartre said, anguish is the expectation of not finding myself at that appointment. Indeed, the expectation of finding that when the time comes, you no longer even wish to be there. Ever have dreams where you're supposed to be there for the big examination or for your wedding or for mother's birthday or father's funeral or something, and you're not there, and you find out and it's too late and you go running over and everybody's left? You don't have those dreams. But we have them in the States a lot. Anyway, anguish is kind of like that dream where you know that you're supposed to be there. You're supposed to be here in the future, and you're coming through your life closer and closer, but what if you never get there? And what if, not only do you not get there, but at some point, maybe around right here, you say, not only am I not going to go there, I don't want to go there. And this idea that your desires will change so fundamentally that you won't even want to have realized your goal, to be a neurosurgeon, to be a great politician, but you'll say, yeah, I'd rather play scat. You could. There's nothing that prevents you from doing that. And so freedom is bad news. Freedom is no excuses. Freedom is something you want to get away from because it's a very uncomfortable realization. And so we have this guy who's surrounded by freedom. It's all around him. He says, I can't escape it. And I've got the phrase up here, flight as a coping strategy. Now, first of all, the word flight, that's what you do when you're trying to escape from the realization that you are so horribly free. And I used the word coping strategy a few weeks ago, and people in the room had some problems with it. I don't remember how we resolve those problems, but it's kind of like a survival strategy. It's a strategy if you want to cope with something, you've got a problem, you deal with the problem. And it could be a bad marriage, it could be a bad philosophy or psychology teacher, it could be a health condition, but you deal with it. You adjust, you accommodate, you devise little maneuvers that you perform. And that's what we in English call coping. So flight is a strategy that the ordinary person uses to escape from this terrifically oppressive thought that you can do anything you want, including taking your clothes off on the balcony, fleeing in battle, turning over your resolutions, and so on. Now, are you with me on that? Just the top part? I've tried to kind of dramatize this idea of how anguish and the fact that the knowledge that you are free is not happy news. Okay. There's an irony here, though, namely that as this fellow is running away from freedom, he's trying to suppress the awareness that he could do anything he wants. In other words, he wants to be like the champion of sincerity. He wants to say, I can't help it. This is my destiny. I have to do it this way. I have to be a homosexual. I have to be a medical student. I have to be a macho man. I have to be a good Christian. I have to behave myself. And he wants to suppress the thought that he doesn't have to. He can do any damn thing he wants. But the fact that he's running away from his freedom, he's trying to forget his freedom, means that he knows what he's running away from. And the very fact that he's moving away from the thought of freedom indicates that in some unconscious way, he's very aware of freedom. It's not that he stopped thinking about freedom, it's that he can't stop thinking about freedom, and so he's pretending like he doesn't remember that he's a free agent. This is one of the ironies that runs through a lot of literature, not only Sartre, but especially Sartre. And so what is our poor refugee here going to do? Well, here's a little trick that Sartre suggests. Suppose that I'm one of those characters in the examples we saw earlier, you know, the lady on the balcony, the soldier, and so on. Suppose I would say, I've decided to pursue my career in medical school, and I've decided to marry the woman that my family picked out for me. But you know, I don't have to do this kind of thing. I could give up my career and I could break my engagement. Lots of people do. One could do otherwise. And I say one here in the French sense of l'on, or in the German sense of man. Man kann das machen. But this is the anonymous one. And so I'm trying to have it both ways. I'm trying to say, yes, I have chosen this. But notice I don't say, but of course I could do otherwise. I say one could do otherwise. Other people, lots of people have done this in the past. Lots of people have broken their engagements. Lots of people have come out of the closet at the age of 75. Lots of people have taken their clothes off on balconies. And so on and so on. And so Sartre says, well, this is an inauthentic strategy, but it's an interesting one, where we try to have it both ways. We describe ourselves personally as committed to a course of action, but we try to say it's not determinism because other people do otherwise. Well, how about these other people? How about you? Why don't you do otherwise? And so finally, we have this notion of the inevitability of bad faith. And I'll have to talk about that later. But bad faith is the term that Sartre uses for anybody who is more or less successfully denying the fact of his or her own freedom. I'll repeat that. Bad faith is the word that Sartre uses to describe somebody who more or less successfully is denying the fact of his or her own freedom. Another word that I think I've already reminded you of is inauthenticity. Okay, that's the bad news. Now here's the good news. I told you that there's this distinction between essence and existence. Well, as we go through our existence and as we make our choices, we are leaving a path, a wake. Do you have in German a word like wake, like when you're skiing and you leave the tracks, or when you're water skiing and you can see the marks in the water from left by? No? What do you call it? Die Spur. Yeah, ein Wasserspur maybe? Yeah, okay. Well, we use the word wake, although I suppose you could say track as well. But it's that which you have secreted. And Sartre has the example, he has two examples. One is of a snail who secretes that slimy substance, you know, so you can see where the snail has been. Okay, that's supposed to be your history. You secrete your history. I like the other example he uses of a skier. And at that point he quotes André Gide, who said, glisse, mortal, glisse. And, slide, Kelly, slide, as it were. And if you ski, you'll know it is very gratifying after you skied to look back and see. Of course, some of us see, ein Schuss. Some of us see there's a few little extra bumps there and there are the, blood on the trees and everything else. But anyway, notice the fluidity, the wetness of Sartre's metaphor of leaving a personal history as a spur, or as a viscous substance. And what I'm trying to get at here, and this is picture talk, I know, that as we go through our life and we secrete our history, the older we get, the harder the secretion is. The tracks firm up and they freeze over and they're, as it were, there permanently. And then when you die, your history has hardened. And that's a quotation from Sartre himself. He says, our history hardens at death. Interesting metaphor. But perhaps even more interesting is this metaphor of viscosity, because he introduces, and existential psychologists have made much of this, he's got two metaphors. First of all, freedom, that's pure fluidity, pure water, no color, just utterly formless. And then you've got on the right side where the things are, you've got solid substances, no changeability. But sometimes we experience these combinations of freedom and determinism, of existence and essence. And that is represented by viscosity. You know what I mean by viscous? Slimy, gooey, sort of solid but sort of wet. And that he thinks is descriptive of the unique human condition. Now I won't tell you how he works that into his analysis of sexuality, but I want you to go read the book, so you can do that. Now, instead I'll go back here to another one of his very famous examples, the young man's radical choice. Does anybody know what I'm talking about with the young man? Sartre wrote a few months after the war, he gave a talk in Paris to a bunch of intellectuals, and it was published under a couple of different titles: Existentialism as a Humanism, What is Existentialism, and in some cases just called Existential. And that's where the word really became popular. And he told the story of how during the war a young man came to him and he said, "Monsieur Sartre, I have a problem. I want to go to England to help De Gaulle. to join the Free French Force. But, he said, I have a mother, and I'm her only son. And if I leave, I don't know what will happen to her. We have a little farmhouse and so on. So he has to choose between his mother and his country, la patrie. It's as though we have the story, maybe you do too, of the country mouse and the city mouse. No? Okay, well, forget the mouse. But what is more important, his mother or his country? So he wants Sartre to answer this question. What do you suppose Sartre said? I've already indicated that Sartre himself was not religious. He was an atheist. Now I know you're going to say, well, he said, kid, you have to decide for yourself. And he did say that, not in so many words, but he said that. But after saying, well, you have to decide for yourself, he said, it is significant that you have come with your question to me and not to a priest. Now, why is that significant? What are the values involved with staying at home with mother? And what are the values that are involved with going over to England? And by the way, going over to England was, you didn't just, you know, get on the channel and go over there. You had to go through southern France, the Vichy part of France. You had to go over the Pyrenees. You had to get into fascist Spain and then sneak across to Portugal, which was also more or less fascist. Then you had to hope you could find a boat in Lisbon that would get you, smuggle you into England. And once you got to England, you had to hope that you would not be deported as an undesirable refugee. And if you did go work for Charles de Gaulle, you had to hope that there was something for you to do. It was what we call a long shot. On the other hand, if he stayed home with his mother, he would probably be of some use, but maybe not. There were a lot of question marks for either choice. But what are the values involved? Well, let's stay with mother for a minute. Mother is a farmer, or in a farmhouse. Mother is of the old mentality. Mother is perfectly prepared to collaborate, if necessary, with the enemy, because that's how you get along. There were plenty of priests who were also willing to get along. In fact, some say there was a pope who had that tendency. But the point is that in Sartre's mind, at least, the church and the old values of the country and the values of the bourgeoisie, even for the poor people who weren't even petite bourgeoisie, were in conflict. In other words, the traditional values versus the values of the résistance, which was full of communists, as you know. And so he says to the kid, it is significant that you have come to me and not to the priest. Why is that significant?
Well, because this was his choice between Gandhi and priest. He had made his choice towards his priest's choice.
And in either case, he would be coming to somebody saying, he wouldn't say it in so many words, but he would say, I have decided to do such and such. Will you please tell me that it was a good choice? Will you bless my choice? Yeah. I mean, I don't know how many of you go to church. And if you do go to church, I don't know how many of you go to Catholic churches. And I don't know if those of you that go to Catholic churches, how many of you go to the confession. But I do know that when I was a boy, we were very careful which priest we went to. There were good priests and bad priests. Some priests that would say, oh, don't worry about it. It's mock nicks. Other priests would say, what? And so we had a pretty good schedule of which priest would let us do what. But you don't do that here, right? Glaubus nicht. Okay. So that was his point, you see, that the young man has made the choice. Which was the right choice? We don't ask that question. It's the choice that he made was the right choice. And all he has to do now is work it out as to the implications of his choice. All right, freedom is good news. Continued. You always have the possibility of what Sartre calls conversion. But this is not the kind of conversion that you read about in the Bible. Three examples. A couple of hikers are out on a hike. And one guy is kind of a macho man. The other is, I identify with this other guy. He's sort of not a macho man. And they're walking, and it's hot. And finally, the one fellow says, "Let's stop." And the other guy says, "No," he says, "this is great." And the Sartre puts it, he's tired, yes, the macho man is tired, but he bathes himself in his fatigue. He likes, when the going gets tough, the tough get going, as the slogan goes in the English language. And the other guy says, "Yeah, I'm tired, I can't go any further." And Sartre says, "Yes, you could. You could go further, but at what price?" And for this non-macho man, also known as a wimp, for this wimp to actually say, "You're right, I'm going to go on too, screw it, let's go," would involve changing all of his values, all of his self-conception. It would be a real upheaval. He would be converting over to the macho religion instead of the wimp religion. But it could be done. You could always say, "Yes, I will do it, but at what price?" And then we have the other example of a group of mountain climbers. And they meet a boulder, and there they are. And what do we have, four people there? Now, what are you, let's say you're one of the four. Tell me what you see. I need to call on somebody. You can help me. What do you see? You know the answer to this question. This is you right there. What do you see there? Yeah, well, tell me about that stone. Is it a challenge? Is it an opportunity? Is it a beautiful spectacle? Is it a very interesting geological specimen? Well, you can put your own interpretation on it. And so these four different people, for them, they have four different interpretations and strategies to develop with that boulder. And what if, let's say, the one person says, "Oh my God, it's an obstacle, I can't go any further." And the other one says, no, it's not an obstacle, it's a challenge. Let's see how far we can get. Maybe we can't get past it, maybe we can. Let's give it a try. And so the second person says, "It's a challenge." And maybe the first person would say, "It's a challenge? Yeah, it's a challenge. Challenge. Yeah, let's go. Okay." And now the first person has made a conversion. But this is not just something you do on a little trip in the afternoon. This is something you do with your entire life. And then we have the title of Sartre's novel, Saint Genet. Do you know anything about Jean Genet? Our Lady of the Flowers? Did I hear a voice? Did I see a voice? Did I hear a hand? No? Okay, well, Genet was a friend of Sartre's, and he had a very lurid past. He was a convicted thief. He was not only gay, but he was in the very rough side of the gay community. He had been accused, and we don't know if this is true or false, of murdering somebody. And he had also written some stunning poetry and novels. And in his novels, he talks about all of these bad things that he has done, and he doesn't make excuses. And for Sartre, for somebody to describe his behavior in such honest terms is the equivalent of being a saint. Hence the title of the novel, Saint, Jean, the Heilige Genet. Well, how about that? So we can always convert from one lifestyle to another, and that is what Sartre calls making the radical choice. And that is what in psychotherapy an existentialist therapist will try to get his clients to do. One last thing, I told you we would talk about guardrails. Now this is also very interesting. Remember about what I said about you're on the bus and you think, well, what if I would do such and such? I'd, you know, break out in song, I'd take my clothes off, or I'd put my fist through the window or something like that. Well, what? Okay. Well, we're back to that question again. Here's our guy, and he's walking along the bridge, and there are all these, can you read this thing? It says, call your mother, don't, what?
Take your pills.
Take your pills, yeah.
Don't walk. Don't walk.
Yeah, don't walk. Something, pay your taxes, yeah. Look before you leap, etc. And so on. And these are the norms. These are the values that we live by. And we don't normally challenge them. We take them for granted. We simply act. We go out for a walk, and there are all these guardrails out there, and we just, you know, like, here I am, I want to go from here over to there. Am I going to go through there? Am I going to walk on the top of... No, of course not. I just walk right through here, and I don't think about it. Here I go. I'm just walking just like a person would walk with no philosophical adventure to it whatsoever. But it's always possible to reinterpret the situation. And it's not shown on the screen, except look at the caption here, the guardrails against anguish. Now what does that mean, against anguish? Well, following Sartre, I'm going to change the story a little bit. Suppose that he comes, maybe he comes over here where there are no guardrails, and he's looking down. He says, wow, this is dangerous. You know, what if I fell? I could die. What if I jumped? Well, why not? Well, you tell me. Give me one good reason not to jump, please. You're right here in the victim's seat. Give me one good reason not to jump.
It's a challenge.
A challenge not to jump.
No.
Oh, that would be a reason to jump.
Yes, and you don't know where you are going to get. You don't know what's happening.
That's right. So it'd be interesting on the way down, at least. let me save that question. We'll come back to it. That's a very good point. Give me a reason not to jump. I could get arrested. There's a law against jumping off cliffs. Okay, that's not a very good reason, is it?
You could die.
I could die. So what? Now, by replying, so what, I have neutralized your answer. And now your reason is not that it's a big deal after all. Wow. You say, I could die, and I say, well, duh. So what?
But I say, I can't enjoy my life anymore. It would be a pity. Well, I might be in hell.
Well, so what? Yeah. Well, you say, but what about my family? They would miss me. You hope. So what? Well, they might starve to death. Well, so what? I died. They can die too. The fact they're going to anyway. So what? And over again, every time a reason is given, you neutralize it. You take the stuff out of it. You deflate the reason. It no longer has any power over you. And you finally reach the point where, after going through all of these reasons that turn out not to be reasons, you say, I have no reason not to jump. I don't have a reason to jump, thank you very much. But whether to jump or not to jump is simply a matter of choice. What does Tom Wren want to do today? And that is a real scary thought. At first I was afraid, remember the Furcht versus Angst distinction? At first I was afraid that if I went over the cliff I would hurt myself or die. But now I am in anguish because I realize that I could throw myself across the... And so I don't like that thought. And so consciousness, in particular consciousness of how terrifically free you are, is disruptive. It is what Sartre calls a wound. And in order to minimize this anxiety, we take these guardrails that society has given us, and there we go with the society, we take these guardrails and we use them to distract ourselves from the possibility of doing something radically radical. And so you see he's whistling, he's looking off to the side and so on. He's ignoring this this anguish possibility. But sometimes the guardrails collapse. Now, of course, my story about how I stand there, I think, well, I could jump. What if I were to jump? That's kind of artificial. That's what teachers do when they're talking in class and they don't know what else to say. But let's go to the next slide. Sartre speaks of the alarm clock. The alarm clock, when the bell rings on the alarm clock, it's a summons. It's as though the universe has said, all right, get up and go. But why does the alarm clock have this authority over you? Answer, you have given it this authority over you. You've decided to be a good girl or a nice boy, and you've decided to show up for work on time every day. But what if you decide to take the authority of the alarm clock away? Not necessarily because you're sleepy, although that's a possibility. Maybe you're just tired of being regulated by a silly alarm system. And so as you decide you're going to blow away the alarm clock, you discover your inner self as the freedom of consciousness. Let me read you what's the way Sartre describes this situation. This is more of a Clint Eastwood interpretation. But let me give you the Jean-Paul Sartre text itself. And here comes Georg. He's just in time to hear. Well, come on in, Georg. We're about to have a reading from Sartre. He says, when you discover yourself, he says, then I discover myself suddenly as the one who gives its meaning to the alarm clock. I am the one who by a sign forbids himself to walk on the grass. I am the one who makes the values exist in order to determine my actions by their demands. So I make the values exist. He has another example, or another phrase. He says, as you go through life, in the ordinary course of things, values, by which he means values like the alarm clock value, rules, regulations, etc., they spring up like partridges. What is a partridge? It's a little bird. You go through the countryside, you're walking in a field, and suddenly, boo, boo, boo. They're partridges. A partridge in a pear tree? Well, it's a little bird. It's the kind of little bird that jumps up when you're walking through a field. And those are values. And you didn't tell the values to jump up, but they're there in the very structure of society, in the very structure of the field. And I like that metaphor. All right. Anyway, good faith is paradoxical. Good faith is paradoxical because it's impossible to take sincerity, and by sincerity, Sartre means spontaneity, freedom, not being regulated or determined or bossed around. Sincerity is when you are your own man, your own woman. But you cannot make this into a policy. Because if you make it into a policy, then it's like the alarm clock. You have to do it. So the implication is that good faith is an ideal, but it's not realizable. And we have the Möbius strip here where you have this idea. Say you are sincere and you follow your sincerity. I'm trying to be on the underside. Well, anyway, the point is that the more sincere you try to be, the more insincere you become. Paradox, vicious circle, whatever. The fact is, it's not a particularly comforting thought, even though I've referred to it as good news. Now, quite a bit more briefly, I'd like to talk about Sartre's model of the mind. And I think that I can be forgiven, at least I have forgiven myself, for not going into too much detail here because the slides are magnificent. This is more of the Tom Wren architecture here. We have, once again, nothingness versus being, or if you wish, consciousness versus the object of consciousness, subjectivity versus objectivity. This is what we had 40 minutes ago. Indeterminate versus unstructured. And let's talk just for a moment about what this is. The consciousness is always changing. The metaphor here is fluid, as opposed to stable, solid things that are out there, things that you know, things that are, they may not be physically solid, maybe they're things like the formula for a triangle, but they're definite, they don't change, they're simply there. And similarly, consciousness is active, consciousness is always doing things. Consciousness decides what to look at. Things are passive, they don't decide who looks at them, who examines them. To refine this idea just a little bit further, we have here this idea of freedom. This really summarizes what I've been saying for the last several minutes, namely that we have existence versus essence. We have this idea that we are always creating. We are creating relationships. We don't find ourselves in relationships. Well, we do, but that's not the point here. Whereas you and I are creating relationships with each other, these two bottles on the table here, I see one is on the right side and the other is on the left side. They have a relationship. They're next to each other. But they didn't create that relationship. This bottle doesn't have the slightest idea or interest in its relationship to that bottle. They're just there. They are in themselves. They are on sich. Whereas you and I, we are in relationships with each other and with ourselves. We are pour soi, we are for sick, we are for ourselves. And for ourselves, that's Hegel talk for being aware of yourself. And on sick, that's Hegel talk for not being aware of anything. But then we have as a special case this idea of self-consciousness. Because if consciousness is completely indeterminate, completely open, and if being an object, being a thing, is being completely closed, how can I have a consciousness of my consciousness? But I do. Well, to find the answer to that, I think you'll have to read Jean-Paul Sartre's Being and Nothingness. But if you don't have time, and if you have a good sense of self-preservation, you might want to take the shortcut and just go on see the stuff that's all on the web. And we have this idea of existence preceding essence. It's a famous Sprichwort of existentialism. I hope by now you can get a rough idea of what that means. It means that your free choice precedes the kinds of physical and psychophysical structures that you find yourself within. We have a nice little set of diagrams you can look at later. Existence precedes essence in these different senses. I know it's too fast for you to read, but I just want you to see what's on the slide. You can go back later if it's interesting to you. So then we have Jean-Paul Sartre creating Jean-Paul Sartre. We have a relationship that comes out of Descartes and then Sartre. These are all variations on the same theme that I've been working for the last hour. So there's more we could say on this, but not today. His method of inquiry, the application. Phenomenology was the introspective study of consciousness, and it studies the way things appear, not what they are, but how they appear. And it can be applied to consciousness in many different ways. And the way that I'm most interested in is the title of Sartre's book, The Transcendence of the Ego. I've misspelled the word transcendent. But the point is, the ego is something out there that you know. You construct it. It's your personality. It's not you. You're not your ego. You know your ego. You like your ego. Maybe you don't like your ego. You create your ego. But you're not identical with it. Then we get to the last of the four columns. We have this idea of Sartre's conception of self and society, and we have this famous example of the stare, le regard. You walk into the classroom, you drop your book, you're late, everybody's looking at you. Why is this such an unwelcome experience? Why is it you don't like it when people look at you in this way? You don't like it because you have been turned into an object. Women are more familiar with this than men. Maybe some of you guys have been in situations where you've been looked at the way lecherous men look at women. You're in a gay bar, or you're in one of these nightclubs and so on, and they're looking at you, and you don't like that. Well, think about this, gentlemen. This is what your sisters have been going through, and your mothers and your aunts have been going through all their lives. And it's ask any lady in the room. It's not a welcome experience, because we are being turned into an object. And then, of course, what you do when somebody looks at you like that, if you're clever, you look back at them and you turn him into an object. And you say, "Who are you looking at, Buster?" Now he's the one that's threatened. And this, what is going on here, is what Hegel called the master-slave relationship. One person is dominating the other person, and the person who is being dominated, by recognizing that the master is dominating him, says, "Oh, you think you're the master, huh?" And now the master's being dominated. And it goes back and forth, back and forth. Other metaphors that Sartre uses are sadism, masochism, etc. I just mentioned this because I promised you a little sex today, and that's the reference to... Okay. It's a duel of subjectivities, and his final view of the relationship of people in society is that hell is other people, and man is a useless passion, meaning the more we want to make ourselves into a free person, the more we want to recover our sincerity, the harder it is. And so, this, you know, life is tough. Whoops. Sartre's relevance to contemporary psychology, it runs through many different ways. We have existential psychology, we have logotherapy, we have non-directive therapy, we have other self-actualization methods. And running through all of these forms of therapy is this idea that Sartre of Sartre's, namely that we have to take our existence, our future, into our own hands. We have to take responsibility for making ourselves what we are, and although we can recognize that the environment and our genetic endowment and other things have had a lot to do with who we are, we can always change ourselves. This is a hard doctrine. It's a hard doctrine, but maybe some of you will become therapists. And if you do, you'll probably, whether you use Sartre or not, you will probably be conflicted over to what extent you will encourage people to take control over their own lives, because sometimes they will take control over their own lives and make a mess of it. So, I would like to say a couple of things before we break off. One is, I'm very grateful for your allowing me to speak in English. I'm sorry if I spoke too quickly, but I see a couple of people that said no. Some of you probably wish I had spoken a little more quickly so you could get out of here earlier. But without wanting to sound like, you know, the hopelessly ugly American, may I suggest, I think you're very wise to have your English so well developed. And you should think of it as you're recovering your own language, because English is simply a kind of a derivative of Deutsch. Actually, Deutsch is a derivative of Deutsch too. But we're cousins, right? We're better. But you have this distinct advantage of having this access through your own home language of the language that seems, for better or for worse, to be dominating scholarship and world culture. And so I don't know if you find it as difficult to learn a foreign language as I do. What is it? Deutsche Sprache? Schwere Sprache? You betcha. Boy, I couldn't have put it better myself. Well, I guess I probably could have. But at any rate, thank you very much. As you go through the rest of your studies, what can I say? Schweristes. Ein berufliche, empfindliche, professional design. But I think it is worth it. Ich danke euch für ihre Aufmerksamkeit, Geduldigkeit und Humor. So, vielen Dank. You have an announcement, one?
Not to over that part of the lecture, the philosophical rules of psychology. Let me also add, I found a lot of paradoxes in his presentation. Just to mention two. First, he used only like six philosophers, and we get the impression he mentioned all. It's such a big word in prison. And there's another paradox, although he's American, he presented only European, German, French, and a few British guys. So it was I consider it a compliment to our history, but I think there's more to it. We also have to study American philosophy and East Asian. And thank you very much, and have a good journey to the New Year.